Today is Tuesday, October 11, 2022. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Glad to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, you had given us in part three a wonderful recounting of your activities in the summer of 1963. You mentioned that fall you had set up a base in Tucson.
Right.
And some U of A housing with actually in your pup tent in the front of Terry Gustafson's Quonset hut.
Yes.
Can you pick that story up, please?
Yes, I will start there because when I left Wupatki, I went and traveled around northern New Mexico quite a while, and the Hopi villages again, and the idea was I was trying to prepare where I could go for the fall and winter, and Terry and Rosalind told me to come to Tucson, that it would be perfect down there. I could do a lot of interesting work. So I did end up down in Tucson and first stayed at their Quonset hut, which was the Polo Village. It was on this huge grass field that was the original polo field for the university team. They had a polo team in the old days before the war, and they had all these students coming back after the war on GI Bill, and Terry was on that. Well, he wasn't Second World War at all. I take that back. He
right.
had been drafted, but he did qualify for the married student housing out at the Polo Village, and he and his wife invited me there. Just as an aside, the amazing coincidences that happened, my in-laws, my father-in-law, Jack Curry, he was in the Second World War, and when he came out, he was from Arizona, and he went to the U of A on the GI Bill and stayed in Polo Village, too, and my wife remembers being there as a free schooler out there, so it was just an amazing coincidence. But what I did do was, by some luck, I found and got a job at the Tucson Art Center, which was the only quasi public and private art museum in Tucson. It was downtown,
mm-hmm.
right, next to the downtown area, in a old Hispanic-like mansion. Looked like an old Pueblo building, as a lot of them did, but it was a pretty low-key operation. There was just the director, and I was labeled as the curator, and there was a lady that met with the public when they came in. But the job was incredibly good for me at the time because there were traveling art exhibits from the major museums back east in New York and Washington and Chicago that came through places like Tucson on a regular schedule. And they had, you know, real fine art. There were paintings and lots of Greek and Roman things, and
wow.
There'd be an Egyptian program, and they would come in and be at the art center there for in the museum for maybe 6 weeks.
Okay.
And it was very organized because the show would come by truck, and everything was crated up very securely, amazingly preserved, and I learned good lessons there. But when it would arrive, it was my job to receive it and get it downloaded into the big storage workroom and unpack all the crates, leaving them all together because I was going to have to repack them in there
right.
To go to the next show. And then the director and I would, he mainly, I just was the grunt, but he would, you know, develop a plan for where this art was going to go in the room. And then on a weekend, we'd have a kind of from the time it closed on Saturday to when it opened on Monday or Tuesday, we would take down the previous exhibit, put up the new exhibit, and then I would spend quite a few days packing up the old exhibit and getting it shipped to the next city that it was going to. And so I would work probably 10 or 15 days just solid, nonstop, and long days, long hours. And then I got 2 weeks off, basically.
Nice.
So I, you know, jumped at the chance because I could then go camp and explore and hike and photograph.
Oh, nice.
All I wanted. So that was just perfect for me. I loved it. And the other thing that I still recall so amazingly, this mansion, which I described as modern-built, kind of Pueblo-like building, flat-roofed, and with the log sticking out of it up there, and Santa Fe style, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually pure Tucson style, but that's okay. Up on the roof of the main building, they had constructed this cute little craftsman cottage.
Oh, wow.
And it was small, maybe 20 by 40 at the most, one big room that had a bed and a little living room side. It has a decent kitchen on one side of the room and a bathroom in the back. And that went along with the job.
Oh, wow.
So it was perfect for me because where this was located on the inside of the block of the city there, it was basically dark in there. And at night, I could process the film and print pictures all I wanted. And there was a stairway that went up the outside next to, it's a big building that was they had art classes in it, but there was stairways going up there with a locked gate, and I'd go up, and then I'd walk across the roof on this catwalk of wood, and there was my little house.
Nice.
It was so bizarre, but so appropriate, and unfortunately for me, in December, so it was only like 3 months that I was there, I got the greetings, you are to report to the draft office in about 5 days. So in San Jose, California, because that was my official address.
Okay.
And, in Los Altos, and they then it was sent, as I described, to my parents, sent it on to me, general delivery, and it went to a couple post offices and got to me, and I had to run down to my boss and say, I've been drafted. And he panicked and, oh no, when do you have to go? And I, you know, it was like 4 days later, I packed everything up and headed for California.
So, and, Alan, hang on a second. Before you before you continue, I want to know just a little bit more about the 3 months you had in Tucson that fall of 1963. Did you meet any of the kind of core group of hikers in Tucson at that time? I'm thinking of Pete Calgill, Eber Glendenning, Lorna Glendenning, John McComb, Joanna McComb. Those kind of five folks, did you meet them? And if so, how did you meet them?
Well, Terry Gustafson was part of the hiking group. He knew them.
Okay.
And introduced me. And I was, you know, went to all the meetings they had. They called themselves the Roma Ramblers, and made a point of whenever they went out hiking overnight to have a gallon of spirits along, but that's where the Roma came from.
Thank
the
you.
Wine. And they, so I knew all of them. The ones you listed there exactly, and was out hiking with them constantly. Well, on my 2 weeks off, I would be out. Schedule all my trips to where I could go with them, and they readily accepted it and were enthused with what I was doing, and all great, really neat people. And again, just doing hiking and climbing and caving when it wasn't popular.
Yes.
You know, the majority of the college students have no idea what they were doing or why or if it was any value at all. But I loved it. I have a whole list of maybe 15 or 20 hikes and trips and overnights. And then they, you know, recommend places that I go when I was on my own time. So
nice.
It was a very, very busy 3 months.
Okay. And again, before we move on here, can you please paint me pictures of what you remember about these people at that time?
Well, I don't know about. I was more on the sidelines because I was kind of just dropped in there, and I wasn't a student, and I really enjoyed them and appreciated them. They were very dynamic, all of them. They got along very well, and I was so amazed to find a group of students my age. They were mainly in graduate school by then, I guess, but they, you know, that were very receptive, felt the same way I did about wilderness and groups, not the government, not destroying wilderness. They didn't demonstrate or they basically just made it well known that they loved the wilderness and they loved going out and exploring it and doing it.
Nice.
And just having a very good time and supporting each other. And so really don't know about those people, what I would say about them. I don't know.
Okay.
They were just good people.
That's good. That's what I needed to know. Okay, so you're in a panic. You have a few days to get to Santa Rosa.
San Jose.
San Jose, thank you. Thank you. And so you hop in the fare lane and take off?
Yes.
Okay.
And got there, and Dad takes me down to San Jose to the bus, and a whole busload of guys, very, you know, not really knowing what's going to happen. What is this?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed I was kind of older than most of them. Most were just out of high school. And I was, what would I have been, 23,
mm-hmm.
22?
Yep.
Something like that. And went to Oakland, where the reception center was, and went through and got the final physical, the haircut, the uniform, took the oath of, not office, but the oath, the Army. You know, you had to swear that you'd maintain the Constitution sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were, I think, bused down to Camp Pendleton. No, Camp, what is it now? I'll get the words wrong. But in Monterey, it's not an Army base anymore, but it sure was then.
Okay.
I'll remember that when I come out. For basic training.
Okay.
And I, you know, and that was interesting. I had no problems. I was in good enough shape. I had been out. You know, the big deal was to go overnight with your squad and camp and pup tents. And
you were right at home.
Most of the guys. Really, this was a new experience, and I, you know, said, "No, this you'll be fine." And I then I at the end of the basic training, which was when I want to say 9 weeks, it was almost 3 months, but you then had these aptitude testing that they gave to everyone, and waited for a while, and then I got my orders, which was to go to Anchorage, Alaska. And I thought, okay, that sounds good to me. I mean, I think I mentioned before that it was a family tradition of going to Alaska.
My grandmother
had during the Nome Gold Rush, my father and uncle had gone on a square rigger sailing ship to Kodiak and the salmon canning business for the American Can Company. So when I told them that I was been stationed to Anchorage, Alaska, it was all, oh, that's good. Make sure you do this and go there and go somewhere else. So they had no problem with that.
Nice.
Vietnam was just starting.
Okay.
It wasn't a formal declaration yet. There was American troops there, but it was at the end of the 2 years that there were major companies from Alaska that went to Vietnam.
And,
But the experience up there for me was really, I grew up a lot, and just the extra 2 years helped a lot in that. And I found that I really was in a good situation. I was a clerk typist in the battalion headquarters.
Okay.
And it was the aviation battalion, which had the airport and all the helicopters and fixed wing. And the Army used to, they really delighted at that time pointing out that the Army had many more aircraft than the Air Force. But the Air Force had big ones, not the little ones. But anyway, I figured out that I could really enjoy Alaska without trying too hard. I found that I had it, and I don't know how much you want to go into this part of the Alaska experience.
I do.
I'll keep going then. I'll try to get through it quick enough to get back to the Grand Canyon, but
it'll wait. We'll get there.
I was a clerk in the battalion office and typed up the stuff that the colonel letters that he had to type accident reports, because unfortunately planes fell out of the sky and was bad news. And those were done, everything had to be done in a very specific, formal layout on the page. Everything, well, on those it had to be perfect typing, no corrections.
Oh, wow.
And back then, I was very fortunate that they actually had gotten a IBM Selectric typewriter.
Oh, wow.
On me. And it was one that had the ball in the middle.
Yeah.
Hit the, and there was a tape that went across with the ink on it, and you could sometimes use the tape a couple times, but it was very, I found that I was pretty cool about the stuff, because they would be very rushed to get an accident report in, and it had to be perfect. And several times I would be sitting there typing in the evening, and the colonel and all the other officers were standing around me watching every key hit. And I just could, forget about them and just do the job.
Nice.
And what I found was the most important thing, I had plenty to do all day, every day.
Nice.
Most of the troops up there didn't have anything to do most of the day, and it was makeup work, and they were very frustrated and angry. And, But I had a job, and I published all the orders for the battalion, and any promotion, anytime going somewhere for Army work or training, or even going home and back, you had to have orders in your hand, in your pocket, that said that you officially were on this date, we're going here and coming back this other date.
Got it.
And but those had to be typed in a very specific code. Every letter had to be right, or the order wasn't valid.
So ooh.
I had that, and then, they were. I would type these, like the orders, on a stencil, and then they were. I would mimeograph them, and I don't know if people know what it's. You'd put the stencil on this rotating drum, and you'd ink it, and then turn on the machine, and you could print as many copies as you wanted, with this stencil, and it was definitely more complicated than, well, now with computers, it's completely different.
Right.
But I found that, and I don't, it sounds kind of trite, but by doing my job and you know, doing it well because I enjoyed it, but they like to reward, and the reward I wanted was a 3-day pass.
Ah.
And it came down to, after a couple months there, I always had a 3-day pass in my pocket.
Nice.
And then sometime during the week, I would take off and I explore Alaska, go down to Whittier, go out to the glaciers, going up in the mountains, even hiking and backpacking in the mountains with friends. And
nice.
I had, you know, and that gave me, you know, real, I could focus on things other than the Army, because there's a lot of about the Army in those days that was not a big deal, not nice. But I got through it quite well. And when the winter came, like in September,
yeah,
on the base, all the infantry troops were all trained as snow troops, you know, on skis, snowshoes, and vehicles that went on the snow, and camping out in the snow. And so the Army had a ski area up on the mountains above, well, it was in the fort still, but it was up a couple thousand feet in the Chugach Mountains.
Mm.
And it was also available for troops off duty, because they really encouraged everyone to, you know, learn about the snow, learn about the winter, have fun at it. But I had skied before in California, and so I thought this would be neat, and got to the point where I would get off work even midweek, like Wednesday, and just across the street there was this big 6x6 Army truck that had two benches in the back and there was a cover over it, and anyone who wanted a ride up to the ski area could just go and get on.
Nice.
And there was the high school ski team went up that way, and and found other friends that went up, and the ski area was floodlit at night, and I could rent all the equipment for like $1 or $1.50.
Mm.
And they had a little, a cafe up there at the warming hut, and I could get a hamburger and ski till like 9 o'clock and come back down. And I enjoyed it. I got better and better at the skiing, and it really kept my sanity, because I could focus on these neat things that were that I could do.
Hmm. Okay.
And the other thing, at one point, I knew they had a competition for the Soldier of the Month.
Okay.
In my group and my friends, it was kind of a, you can't be serious, who would want to, but because, you know, we were all drafted and all had about an average of 3 years of college.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if they just factored that into the selection, but everyone in our battalion there had, you know, at least 2 years of college and sometimes and three. But the lieutenant that was over my office, he made the point that it would be really cool if somebody could be the soldier of the month for the fort, and because the infantry colonels would whoever got that for the month would really hold it over the aviation and other groups, and our colonel would really like that. And I said, okay, if I can have a little time to prepare for it. And the other thing that was the great was that I would probably get a promotion.
Ah.
And I said, okay, this is sounding better, because I knew as a E5 that the whole environment would change. And see, I could get a semi-private room.
Ah.
And I could go to the NCO club, which I really didn't do because that wasn't my thing.
Right.
So long story short, I did get the soldier of the month, and it was a great benefit. I got, you know, the whole environment for me changed, and I had lots of interesting stuff. The thing I do want to mention that was important was that the sergeant across the hall, who was in one of the procurement offices, he had a friend, Andy Andrews, who had retired from the battalion and had moved to the Alaska Range and had a home site that you could get from the States on the side of the Alaska Railroad out in the wilderness.
Oh, wow.
And the friend was going up there to visit with him and said, come along. And so on a weekend, we went down and got on the Alaska Railroad on Saturday, which went north, and stopped the train at mile 269 and got off and to Andy's, spent the night there, hiked back and forth, and stopped to flag down the train coming south on Sunday. And I really, really, really liked that. So I took about at least three more weekends that I went up there by myself or with a couple other people and got to know him well. And when I got out of the Army, the next winter I came up to the railroad to Andy's and spent 3 months there.
Wow.
And again, hiking, this time snowshoeing up in the mountains to where I could get a view of Mount McKinley, Denali, and just learning about survival in the winter in central Alaska in the mountains.
Who was Andy Andrews?
He was a former sergeant in the same office that I was. And
okay.
He had retired maybe 2 years before and had friends there. And the sergeant that took his place was friends with him and enjoyed going up in the mountains to visit Andy. And so that's coming yet.
And
after the
had he built a had he built a had he homesteaded out there? Had he built a built a cabin? How did that work?
Right. It's the state would give you. You could, I guess, survey or somehow determine your 5 acre, 10 acre plot. I think it was 10 acres, maybe more, for a home site, and you had to register it. And you had to build a house on it, something, a cabin, to, and live on it for a couple of years. And then you got title to the land.
Okay.
And that's what he had done. You know, was, they did not do the old Homestead Act because there's really no reason to have 600 acres of tundra up there. But you could get a really nice home site, and he had built a cabin. I stayed there by himself. He had a little smaller guest cabin, you could call it. And it was a log cabin that he built from scratch from the trees standing in the forest.
Wow.
And that's where I would stay. And, you know, it was a great experience, and it was very compatible, believe it or not, with my travels in Arizona. Though people had a real trouble that I ended up spending my summers in the Grand Canyon and my winters in the Alaska Range.
Wait a minute. Wait, something's wrong here.
That was a really great experience to me.
During these 2 years you were in the service, 64, 65-ish, that time frame there, were you still taking photographs?
No. I left all that at home.
Okay.
I had a 35-millimeter camera, not a very fancy one, an old one I had, and I took those all over Alaska. I had a great, what are now historic pictures of the Alaska wilderness, went to, and I went and spent a week at McKinley Park, back when you could drive back in there all the way by yourself, and camped back there with another sergeant and his family, and they asked me to come along. Enjoyed that. Went all around Anchorage and south to Seward and the Chugach Mountains, and just everywhere I could get to conveniently, not having a car or any of that.
So you didn't have your 8x10, but you had a 35mm, and you were taking pictures with that.
Yes, I was constantly, very seriously.
Got it.
Yeah.
Nice. Good. Yeah, because that would be wonderful to have that record of that time.
Yeah, and this was the earthquake up there was in April of 64. And I got there the next month, maybe about 30 days later.
Mm.
And the country was devastated. Oh, my. We were restricted to the base because it was hard to get into Anchorage even, with the roads so bad. And I felt a lot of aftershocks, which coming from San Francisco, I didn't mind, but I just, and being a geologist, I thought that was really cool. But the descriptions my friends there in the Army described, they were pretty terrifying.
Oh, wow.
When there'd be a shaking, they'd run outside and knock down on or sit on the sidewalk before they fell down. One time, very vivid to me, they're all described looking down the sidewalk maybe two or three blocks, and the sidewalk is all just coming towards them in waves, like the
ocean,
just up and down and up and down. The Army fort, the buildings survived pretty well. Interiors, they had kind of loose little concrete blocks to divide the bays in the barracks there, and those blocks tended to fall down, but they had to rehab the fort completely the first year. And when we finally got to go into Anchorage, there were city blocks downtown where it was the worst destruction, because the very old glacial gravel beds down 100 or 200 feet, the earthquake just shook them up so much that the whole thing collapsed about 50 feet, and all the buildings, all everything were down in a big hole.
Whoa.
And that was, they were still repairing that. And then I liked going out to Seward because there was a Army rest and recuperation, R&R, facility there, which was like a glorified motel, but it had a little, not a restaurant, a mess hall. And when I would have one of these three-day passes, I could get permission to go down there for nothing. They would pick me up in a station wagon, one of these R&R people, because nobody knew about it. Nobody wanted to go down there and hike around in the wilderness, but there was the whole staff, and they loved it when I came.
Oh, wow.
But I had a place to stay. I had food for free, and I really had several good trips down on the peninsula there, just taking advantage of what the Army had.
Nice. I'm just a little confused here. You mentioned that there was a lot of training in cold weather survival, cold weather fighting, those sorts of things. And yet I'm thinking of Vietnam, which is a hot jungle.
Well, yes, you're right. That was one of the problems. The last couple months, in fact, the aviation battalion had to, there were like six aviation companies, and one of them had to be pack up and go to Vietnam from Fairbanks.
Wow.
Which was, and the odd thing that you might wish to mention is that there was an absolute battle to get assigned to that company. The vast majority of the troops in our battalion would do anything to get out of Alaska.
Oh, wow.
Even going to what was going to be a war in Vietnam. And the other thing with the training, for example, when I came, all the flight crews and pilots had to take a week's wilderness survival class, and ending up in, they took them out by helicopter and just left them off in this, you know, everyone scattered around, and you had to have enough experience to know how to build a shelter,
mm-hmm,
under a tree, a snow cave, how to mainly stay put, not go anywhere.
Okay.
And the implication was if you crashed, because they had too many flight crews and pilots who would crash out in the wilderness, and when they finally located them, they had taken their own lives. They were utterly petrified, terrified.
Oh, wow.
Spending the night in the wilderness. And and that made a strong point to me. I mean, I loved the wilderness, and but to realize that a lot of people in this world did not share my enthusiasm.
Or just understanding of how to simply survive on your own, away from all the comforts of, in quotes, civilization.
Right. To me, you just have to plan it right. You've got to have the right stuff, the right equipment. And, you know, I stopped discussing it because, to me, the preparation and the mindset for hiking in the Grand Canyon in 105 degrees in the summer is the same as camping and surviving in the Alaska winter time at down below. It just, you had to have the right mindset, and I thought they were very compatible, but no one else did.
That's fascinating. I would have never thought of it like that, but yeah, if you have the skills to be out of doors comfortably anywhere, then you know, you can translate that to someplace else.
And the good part was, after that wilderness, you know, survival class, everybody who was, you know, crashed or had a problem or was accident or was out in the wilderness, they all survived.
Nice.
And the main thing was not to go anywhere.
Okay.
You can get out of the plane and get away from it, but stay right there.
Okay.
But that's, you know, but I felt strongly about that.
And did you climb the ranks, or are you still an E5?
Oh, I was an E5. That was very unusual because I just, by the position of where I was and the opportunity to be noticed and to, you know, it's unfortunate, but someone like me who did his job seriously stood out. There were too many goof-offs that the officers were worried about. But I was a specialist, and right away, about 6 months, I was at Spec 4, which was early. And then by getting the Soldier of the Month, I was a Spec 5, which there were very few. And that's the, you know, the grade of the sergeants, the platoon sergeants and all of that. So I had made a definite jump, and when I could go, I was on the first plane. You know, the colonel himself called me in and said, you know, I have an idea you're going to be heading to California, but I want you to know if you would accept it, I'd support you for an officer candidate school. So I appreciated that. And he didn't have to say that, but it was good. And the other, it's kind of funny, but wasn't at the time, that I was skiing, you know, on the weekends, and it would turn out that oftentimes the troops, the privates that are just there, would, on the weekend, on a Friday or Saturday, would go into Anchorage, and there was a huge row of bars and whatever you would call the red light district, and get in fights and get drunk, and the Anchorage police would call, and it turned out that several weekends, there was always a duty officer downstairs to be in the office just in case war broke out or whatever. But their main duty was dealing with these drunk troops. one of the, well, the sergeant that was there really didn't want to go out downtown and deal with that, and he came up and asked me, would I go and do it? Well, check out a Jeep, go down, get the guys out of jail, bring them back, and let the companies deal with it. And I said, well, yeah, I'm, yeah, it turned out, he said, you're the only sober NCO in the building. So I would get the Jeep, drive down, bring them back, and that weighed very heavy on my 3-day pass thing. So it was just a matter of figuring out how the Army worked and doing what was appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of sad in a way to it's understandable, but it's sad that that just, you know, we were so we found that whole environment so strange, different, and looked at it as a place where there was nothing to do.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, in the companies, there were maybe, I could say 15 or 20 from New York, New Jersey, that they admitted to having, the judge gave them a choice.
Oh.
But, you know, join the Army or go to jail.
Okay.
And they chose the Army, but they came to Alaska, and these guys from, you know, the various parts of New York City, for example, they were utterly terrified of outside of the building.
Wow.
It was, you know, they were going to be attacked by something, by grizzly bears or wolves or
right,
whatever, and they would just, you know, go to the PX and drink and come back, and it was always very sad to me because I just had, and my friends had just more than enough to do. We just would always have something to do.
Yeah. And I did also want to ask you, since you're in Alaska, about the Northern Lights. I'm assuming that
that
was part of your winter experience.
Yes. It's just, it was great. From the dorm, anytime the lights would be on, everybody would just kind of say, check out the lights out there.
And
some of us would. I always enjoyed it. I was also surprised, one of the trips that I went down to Seward in the summer, when it was basically only 2 or 3 hours of dark night, was the most fantastic aurora that I saw at any time.
Oh, wow.
Just all of them, you know, in fantastic motion and waves and different colors and zipping across the sky. So I was surprised myself where down there and everyone went out and the whole city watched it on that.
Did you get any leave during that time to actually get back down south to California to visit with your family?
I came once for Christmas.
Okay.
And back. And that's all it was. It wasn't any problem, but it was just a big hassle to do it. It was on military standby, which was done really well. There were empty seats on planes, so you know, you knew you were going to get on your flight. The only strange one was going from Anchorage to Seattle and then going on to San Francisco, because I went out to the airport, whatever, it was probably Alaska Airlines, but and asked the lady, and she looked through all her papers, oh, yeah, here you are. And she walked over to the window and said, you see that plane way over there on the runway, that there's some trucks by it? Yeah, well, that's the plane you're getting, and you better get over there pretty soon, because they may get ready. So I had my suitcases and basically jogged over there, and there was all but a ladder going up, but went in, and it was full of cargo, and there was a stewardess, and surprised to see me, and then she said, oh, you're the one that's going south with us. Okay. So she goes in kind of a closet there, takes out this folding seat that bolted down and hooked it on to the floor.
Wow.
And I was the only passenger, and we flew down to Seattle that way. I didn't care. They were nice. The flight was nice. So that was only one time. And when I came back and out of the Army, I had a lot of stuff. I had snowshoes and cross-country skis and old-fashioned skis and backpacks, and I even had a hunting rifle because Andy Andrews wouldn't let me go snowshoeing way up in the wilderness if I didn't. You know, he was sure I was going to be attacked by a moose or a grizzly bear. And seriously, because, you know, he had reports of people harassing bears, and you just didn't. And the other thing I just thought of is couple times I flew from Anchorage to Fairbanks to work with the other half of the aviation battalion, and would spend a couple days training a lot of the clerks on the new rules and all. But the Alaska Airlines, and they were very busy, but when you came in to the plane and you climbed up the stairs and went in, there was a big area there that was a gun cabinet. And they asked, just please, you know, make sure your guns aren't loaded, and please leave them there. And they would be full. There'd be 15 or 20 fancy hunting rifles, lots of handguns, and just out in view, just right there, was no big deal.
And, you know, to me, that makes kind of perfect sense, because when you live in a land where creatures are big enough to eat you, you know, it might be nice to have some sort of way to defend yourself. Were you able to save some money then, over those 2 years?
I did, and that's what I definitely found that I could. And so I had couple thousand dollars, actually.
Wow.
And that was enough to buy a 4x5 view camera and to take off to pick up where I left off in Arizona, really on the north rim of the Grand Canyon.
And that was in 1966?
Yeah.
Okay.
Could we think we could continue there?
Yeah, I think this is a perfect place to go ahead and wrap that up. Is there anything else in this hour we just spent here talking about your service in Alaska that you want to bring in that you haven't.
Oh, not really. I just, have really good memories of the Army because I got to see so much of Alaska. And the Army had, all the problems in Vietnam and everything there, right? Just kind of kept myself out of that and just
right.
had enough that I could do that I could really look forward to all of that.
I have one last question for you before we wrap this up. Did you get a chance to see any canning in operation in Alaska when you were there?
No.
Okay.
I didn't. I'd seen the canning in San Francisco with my father worked at Folgers Coffee, and when I'd go up to the city for whatever reason and want to ride back with him, I'd go by the factory, and I knew most of they all knew who I was.
Oh, sure, I bet.
And they'd so I was really aware of the coffee canning, not the salmon canning.
Okay, well, with that, let's go ahead and put a comma here in this oral history series and conclude part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Tuesday, October 11th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.